Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Eamon Murphy, I'm Economic and Social Analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Hopefully you and yours are keeping safe in these strange and unprecedented times in which we find ourselves, and hopefully as well you've been finding some entertainment and education in these podcast episodes. For this episode, we go back to our social policy conference in 2018 and a presentation by Paddy Cosgrave, founder and CEO of Web Summit. Paddy's presentation focused on, amongst other things, the way in which high concentration of wealth can endanger democracy and on the treatment of different types of income for taxation purposes. I think if there's one positive thing to come from this pandemic and the subsequent lockdown, it has been the increased willingness of many people to reconsider how we've structured our society, including the extent to which our society is built around the needs of capital rather than the common good. Paddy's presentation, though delivered almost 2 years ago, is a timely reminder of how we can learn from the past in order to shape the future. This will be the last episode of Social Justice Matters for a few weeks, as the office is closing for the first couple of weeks of August. It's been a very busy year so far, with a general election and a pandemic on top of all the usual landmarks and events that keep us busy. Hopefully you enjoy Paddy's presentation, and you should check back here again in a few weeks' time for more episodes.
Thanks so much. So, nothing I wish to share today is related to anything I've learned running a business. I think as Adam Smith and writers from antiquity, good writers from antiquity onwards, have observed, there's often a mistake in virtue and wisdom afforded to those who have amassed great fortunes. Neither wealth nor influence affords me, in my view, any moral or intellectual authority. If anything, the views of those who've attained excessive and unusual privilege should be, if history counts for anything, treated with the deepest of scepticism. As an undergraduate, I was the editor of the undergraduate academic journal for what I believe is now the School of Social Sciences and Philosophy in Trinity College, Dublin, for 2 years. I later co-founded another similar academic journal. My interests a decade ago in matters of political, moral, or economic philosophy remain largely unchanged, although in recent years, my ability to spend much, if any, time properly considering these topics has reduced dramatically. This is yet another reason to treat my observations today with the deepest of scepticism. I'm professionally entirely unqualified to talk about the important matters being discussed today, so I wish to take a somewhat broader historical set of observations. I'm nevertheless very grateful to Sean and Social Justice Ireland for the invitation. Just to note, much of the material I reference today has in part been initially gleaned many years ago from the footnotes and bibliographies of books by authors including Howard Zinn, Hadjun Chang, Noam Chomsky, Michael Hudson, Bertrand Russell, and many others. So to begin. When the founding fathers of the United States of America were in the 1770s discussing from here to where, they predicated their recommendations on a set of philosophical beliefs regarding justice and human nature, as well as observations on the distribution of power within their nascent society. This period continues to animate and inform much discussion today about the distribution of power and decision-making internal to Irish society. For example, America's founding fathers are regularly invoked by Irish political leaders, and as such, their writings are worthy of closer examination. While the founding fathers were concerned primarily with how you might best organise a just society and guard against the subversion of the public good, other moral philosophers writing in the same period were, and I say this with some caution, somewhat more concerned with economic considerations. This set of moral philosophers, most particularly Adam Smith, are also invoked both directly and indirectly by Irish political leaders as the philosophical antecedents for many of the policies pursued in Ireland today. Personal choice, the free market, hard work, just reward, and classical liberalism are amongst the words and ideas that are commonplace amongst the utterances and speeches of those in power in Ireland today. For those interested in influencing policy decisions in Ireland, an understanding of the supposed philosophical roots of these policies regularly invoked by those in power has therefore some utility. For that reason, we'll turn first to some of the underlying foundations of the avowed philosophical positions of our political leaders in Ireland today. Initially, we'll focus on the nature of political systems and the distribution of power within those systems, and thereafter turn to an examination of the avowed philosophical roots of economic thinking of our political leaders. In 2016, Enda Kenny, speaking in the United States alongside Vice President Joe Biden, observed that down through the generations, Irish leaders drew enormous inspiration from the ideals of your founding fathers. It's an important observation by Kenny, and as to some of the ideals of the founding fathers that we first turn. James Madison was one of the co-authors of the Federalist Papers, the fourth president of the United States, and regarded by many as the father of the American Constitution. Madison wrote that if elections were open to all classes of people, the property of landed proprietors would be insecure. For that reason, he concluded, our government ought to secure the permanent interests of the country, the interests of the minority of the opulent, against such innovations as universal suffrage. In short, Madison understood that civil government was established, as he put it, to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. Alternatively, as it was termed by Madison in Federalist Paper No. 10, perhaps the most famous of all the papers, democracy is permissible, but only if it guards against wicked projects of innovation by those without property or the hope of acquiring it. Another of the three authors of the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton, who Taoiseach Leo Varadkar described recently as the great founding father of America, believed that the majority were an unthinking mass with all the folly of the ass who must have a master as they were only made for reins and spur. John Jay, the final of the three authors of the Federalist Paper, simply concluded that the people who own the country ought to govern it. When Leo Varadkar and Kenny conclude that Irish leaders have drawn enormous inspiration from the ideals of these great thinkers and leaders over many generations, I'm sometimes not sure if they mean these specific ideals or not, in particular because the observations I've shared of Madison, Hamilton and Jay are deeply relevant to some of the most entrenched challenges in Ireland today. Returning to the Founding Fathers, it is important to note that this class of men, as they refer to themselves, believed that the public good would be protected through the benevolent actions and decisions of gentlemen and talents, of gentlemen of talents and character, as they put it. Actions that would be guided by what they termed truth. However, their benevolent aspirations were soon threatened by what Hamilton declared as a dangerous tumour within democracy itself. Hamilton wrote that a new monopolising spirit of speculation threatened to destroy the benevolent aspirations of the Founding Fathers. It was a dangerous tumour that, in his words, must be corrected. If it were not, then democracy itself would devolve into a system which would merely, he added, rob the industrious of the fruits of their labour and enable the idle and rapacious to live in ease and comfort at the expense of the better part of the community. Madison, like Hamilton, warned of a comparable future where government would be found substituting the motive of private interest in place of public duty, leading to a real domination of the few under an apparent liberty of the many. Thomas Jefferson, another founding father, foresaw a similar future, but Jefferson hoped that the benevolent philosophers could crush, in his words, in its birth, the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength amid defiance to the laws of our country. Let me just say that again. Thomas Jefferson foresaw a similar future to all the other founding fathers, but hoped that the benevolent philosophers could crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country. I think it sounds somewhat familiar to some of the challenges we face today. When Leo Varadkar recently referred to Hamilton as that great founding father of America, was it any of Hamilton's concerns of a dangerous tumour at the heart of democracy in a young America that Varadkar felt made him so great? Hamilton's observations and those of many of his contemporaries on the dangerous relationship between moneyed corporations, that's essentially concentrated private power, and democracy itself are very apt in the case of recent Irish history. When Enda Kenny concluded that through the generations, Irish leaders drew enormous inspiration from the ideals of your founding fathers, was it their concerns that a politician might be found substituting the motive of private interest in place of public duty because they would be overwhelmed by a new aristocracy of money corporations? Given our long history of scandals resulting from the interplay of money corporations in our political classes, the words of the founding fathers on these issues are difficult to ignore. The views of the Founding Fathers on the dangerous tumour that has concentrated private power were also constant, and not just from the earliest days of the United States, but right through the next 100 years. Ireland's ambassador to the United States, Dan Mulhall, noted recently that Alexis de Tocqueville was the author of a book that some regard as the best thing ever written about 19th century America and its politics. His observations, therefore, on the dangers of private power overwhelming the public good are worthy of some consideration. For example, in 1831, de Tocqueville urged any friends of democracy in the United States to keep their eyes anxiously fixed on the manufacturing aristocracy which is growing up under our eyes. He believed that it was one of the harshest which has ever existed in the world. Moreover, if allowed, developed unchecked, would lead to a permanent inequality of conditions, thwarting the initial aspirations of the founding fathers and replacing democracy for the people by gentlemen of talents and character, with a system amounting to a real domination of the few under an apparent liberty of the many, to borrow Madison's observations once more. Speaking in the White House this year, Leo Varadkar said, "In my office, I keep and I treasure a collection of speeches and letters by one of your greatest presidents, Abraham Lincoln." I wonder if the Taoiseach treasures the following observations of Lincoln in one such letter in 1864. Lincoln warned that the worst fears of the founding fathers had been realized as, in his words, corporations had been enthroned. He added that an era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavour to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed. Lincoln's conclusions are perhaps an exaggeration, but they are not without an element of documentary legitimacy. Lincoln's warnings, like those of the founding fathers, represent a very consistent set of views with regard to the dangers of concentrated private power overwhelming the public good by capturing political power. This is Hamilton's dangerous tumor at the heart of democracy. That the names of these towering figures are invoked by those in power today in Ireland is, of course, notable. But what's far more notable is the total silence with regard to the many and consistent observations by these historical figures on the dangers of private power overwhelming the public good and capturing much of policymaking in their own interest. From historical observations on political power, let's now turn to the often invoked philosophical basis for various policy positions with regard to matters of work, income and taxation of the current Irish government. Minister for Finance Pascal Donoghue has over many years declared that Adam Smith is everything from the anchor of our modern world to the author of the famed Wealth of Nations to someone who decisively changed how we view the world. Smith, therefore, is worthy of careful consideration, as are the views of those who informed Smith and those who were influenced by Adam Smith. At the core of the Enlightenment, post-Locke at least in my view, was a general agreement on a new division of income. This new division eventually unshackled much of the Western world from the last vestiges of feudalism or aristocratic privilege. This division, in turn, influenced ideas on taxation, work, and productivity right into the modern period. This new division divided income into two parts, unearned income and earned income, known sometimes as unproductive income and productive income. One form of income added to the wealth of a society, as far as all of these thinkers were concerned, the other detracted from it. Unproductive or unearned income was castigated as everything from useless to parasitical to a subtrahend to, most famously by John Stuart Mill, as the unearned increment and then some more. Ultimately, this important division lay at the heart of political economy right through the Enlightenment, informing everything from taxation to public investment to banking. This most crucial division of income seems unfortunately to have been entirely missed by the current government. So what was unearned income? Adam Smith perhaps best described unearned income. Landlords, like all other men, love to reap where they never sowed. This description was echoed for more than 100 years to come by almost every major political economist and moral philosopher. John Stuart Mill, for example, writing probably about 70 years later, wrote that those who own assets often grow richer, as it were, in their sleep without working, risking, or economizing. What claim have they on the general principle of social justice to this accession of riches? When Leo Varadkar invokes imagery of the deserving getting up early to work, he seems entirely oblivious of what was the absolute core division of income during the Enlightenment. This division lay at the heart of critical debates with regard to taxation. There was a broad realization that in order for economies to thrive and exit the death grip of feudalism, the interests of landlords had to be subordinated to that of industry and consumers for the first time in hundreds of years. For example, David Ricardo concluded that the interest of the landlord is always opposed to that of the consumer and manufacturer, adding that the dealings between the landlord and the public are not like dealings in trade, whereby both the seller and buyer may equally be said to gain, but the loss is wholly on one side and the gain wholly on the other. Put another way by Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations, which Pascal Donohue seems fond of referring to, some people foolishly confound rent with profit. These are fundamentally different things, and the division of rent and profit, unearned and earned income, was one of the cornerstones of Enlightenment thinking. Perhaps the current government have confounded rent with profit, to say the least. Returning to the past, it's important to remember that some of the ideas of Smith and those that followed were perhaps most informed by the contribution of the French physiocrats. This group of Enlightenment thinkers were arguably the first to extensively use the term economiste to refer to themselves. The physiocrats produced perhaps the first true national income statement known as the tableau économique. In their view, it isolated the surplus or produit net of an economy and consequently who or what should be taxed. In the 1750s in France, significant asset owners were exempted from taxation. Taxation of various sorts were levied overwhelmingly on working people and small business owners. The physiocrats, through the zigzag of their tableau économique, identified landlords as receiving the largest and most unjustified surplus of income. As this income was essentially unearned, it therefore should be taxed, and taxed heavily. The physiocrats, of which Quesnay was their intellectual leader, called for a l'impôt unique, or unique tax, that would fall mostly on large asset owners. Adam Smith was more than aware of the physiocrats. Smith noted in his famed Wealth of Nations, as Pascal Donohue refers to it, that the tableau économique, with all its imperfections, is perhaps the nearest approximation to the truth that has yet been published upon the subject of political economy, and is upon that account well worth the consideration of every man who wishes to examine with attention the principles of that very important science. The physiocrats' battle cry became laissez-faire. The word laissez-faire comes from the physiocrats. Initially, it was laissez-nous-faire, laissez-nous-passer, and we can maybe discuss that later, which properly translated was simply to mean let the population at large, working people, be free of unjustifiable levels of taxation by shifting the burden onto those, in the words of Mill, who often grow richer, as it were, in their sleep without working. At the time in France, to reiterate, large asset owners were entirely exempted from tax, while everyone else was not. Under the physiocrats' laissez-faire proposals, that was to change. A free market was to be created, which at the time essentially meant a market free of an unfair system of taxation. But what's more, not only were those with large holdings of property exempted from taxation at the time in France, similar to asset-backed funds in Ireland at present, luxury goods were also subsidised, much as is the case today in Ireland with, say, art, but also with education and healthcare. The mere existence of what are called S110s, or ICAVs, or LQIVs, these exceptional tax breaks for large asset owners, is entirely antithetical to the very basis of classical liberalism. It's the opposite of the very cornerstone of Enlightenment ideals with regard to tax, work, and reward. The only way Pascal Donohue could refer to Smith so liberally is if neither he nor his advisors had ever properly read Adam Smith. To be clear, Adam Smith did not shirk from suggesting that large property owners should be heavily taxed, something they are absolutely not in this country. A tax upon rents, Smith wrote, would in general fall heaviest upon the rich. He added that it is not very unreasonable that the rich should contribute to the public expense not only in proportion to their revenue, but something more than in that proportion. Adam Smith furthermore condemned taxes that fall much heavier upon the poor than upon the rich, in particular on the necessities of life. Perhaps echoing the physiocrats' call for a l'impôt unique, a unique tax on assets and rents, Smith wrote that rent on assets was the species of revenue which can best bear a peculiar tax. When Leo Varadkar made reference to those who wake up early and work, he was, I would suggest, entirely unaware, in his defence, of the most important division made during the Enlightenment with regard to economics. All income is not equal. Some income is earned, some unearned. As Adam Smith lamented, though, some people foolishly confound rent with profit. The Enlightenment was in many ways a struggle between unusual privileges granted to large asset holders, which had held Europe in a dark age, and an emerging industrious movement which promised to unleash the forces of new wealth creation through work. Much of the work of Enlightenment thinkers like Smith was an attempt to subvert the interests of huge asset owners like hedge funds today or private equity funds. These large asset owners of old are the equivalent today in Ireland of various funds who have been granted feudal-like tax breaks and income derived from the ownership of large volumes of assets. For many generations, Adam Smith's ideas and those of his contemporaries informed taxation, public spending, and even ideas on banking. Taxes on capital gains, for example, used to be levied in the Western world at broadly the same rate as other forms of income. But now in Ireland in particular, as was the case in feudal France, a certain class of people and organizations who hold large amounts of assets are granted extraordinary privileges. They are, in short, through various asset-backed fund structures, exempted from taxes entirely. The special privileges afforded today in Ireland to asset-backed funds, be they hedge funds or otherwise, represent nothing more than old aristocratic privilege infused with modern marketing techniques. Structurally speaking, exempting a certain set of huge asset owners from taxation in 2018 is no different from 1750s France. Interestingly, Adam Smith, in fact, wrote about the particular case of taxes on foreign owners of assets in Ireland in Wealth of Nations. Odd that Pascal Donoghue would miss this one. Those who live in another country contribute nothing by their consumption towards the support of the government of that country in which is situated their source of their revenue. If in this latter country there should be no land tax, nor any considerable duty upon the transference either of movable or of immovable property, as is the case in Ireland, such absentees may derive a great revenue from the protection of a government to the support of which they do not contribute a single shilling. For Pascal Donoghue and Leo Varadkar to invoke Enlightenment thinkers and ideas without any seeming knowledge appears nothing less than a very unfortunate misappropriation of history. Their misappropriation, or the misappropriation by their advisors and speechwriters, represents the exact problem Michael D. Higgins cited in his inauguration speech with regard to anti-intellectualism. The current government's continued confounding of rent and profit, an absolute critical division of the Enlightenment, is most unusual. But so too is their proclivity to continue to reduce and in some instances entirely remove any forms of taxation on large asset holders while simultaneously subsidizing the purchase of luxuries. This runs entirely contrary to quite literally the core purpose of the Enlightenment, to end the unreasonable dark ages and exceptional privileges granted to a minority at the great expense of almost everybody else. Pascal Donoghue also, I should add, heaps praise on David Hume. I'm a fan of Hume for various reasons, but also happen to own a copy of his, it's worth buying, a 3,500-page History of England, in which Ireland features frequently. As an Irishman, it's difficult to invoke Hume in the context of Ireland, if that is, you've actually read much of what he wrote about Ireland, without at least acknowledging one of his most spectacular observations on the Irish, which I'm sure many people here have heard before. The Irish, from the beginning of time, had been buried in the most profound barbarism and ignorance, as they were never conquered or even invaded by the Romans, from which all the Western world derived its civility. They continued still in the most rude state of society and were distinguished only by those vices to which human nature, not tamed by education or restrained by laws, is forever subject. I think things worked out okay for us in the end, but those are David Hume's actual views on the Irish. So it's difficult to continually invoke him, I think, without acknowledging that most famous line. Similarly, if you actually read Adam Smith's famed Wealth of Nations in the words of Pascal Donoghue, it's hard to miss his peculiar observation on potatoes and Irish prostitutes, which I've seldom, if ever, heard nor read in an Irish context. So I'll share it. With potatoes, the chairmen, porters, and coal heavers in London, and those unfortunate women who live by prostitution, the strongest men and the most beautiful women perhaps in the British dominions are said to be the greater part of them from the lowest rank of people in Ireland, who are generally fed with this root. No food can afford a more decisive proof of its nourishing quality or of its being peculiarly suitable to the health of the human constitution. I think it's an unbelievable observation. If you're kind of interested in different types of bread, the paragraphs before that is actually Wealth of Nations is an obscure book in some ways, but it's actually it's a debate about whether wheat-based bread or oat-based bread is more nutritious. And then he just kind of decides that actually potatoes are the ultimate source of strength and beauty, and cites poor, unfortunate Irish women working in prostitution in London as the basis for his argument. It's an interesting book. To conclude, the great tendencies of our most senior political leaders to invoke America's founding fathers or Adam Smith should in some sense be welcome. As Cicero once noted, not to know what has been transacted in former times is to be always a child. If no use is made of the labours of past ages, the world must remain always in the infancy of knowledge. I understand that by quoting the great ideas of these thinkers, our Tishi and finance minister believe they are demonstrating a certain intellectual competence, that they are not in the infancy of knowledge, to quote Cicero, or anti-intellectual, to quote Michael D. Higgins. And yet, in some ways, it may appear that their absolute misappropriation of the Enlightenment and its ideas shows that they are deeply anti-intellectual. However, I don't believe our political leaders are anti-intellectual. Instead, I think they're very, very, very smart. They rightly realise that there's just no philosophical basis for many of their core policy positions today with regard in particular to work and taxation. Faced with that reality, they simply have to pretend there is a basis by falsely appropriating the ideas of some revered enlightened philosopher or political idealist from the distant past and hope nobody kind of calls them up on it. In the closing paragraphs of the final chapter, chapter 24 of John Maynard Keynes' General Theory is a rather excellent summation of what I have shared and want to end with. I just think it's a brilliant, brilliant kind of closing paragraph. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back. I'm sure that the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. Not indeed immediately, but after a certain interval. For in the field of economic and political philosophy, there are not many who are influenced by new theories after they are 25 or 30 years of age. So that the ideas which civil servants and politicians and even agitators apply to current events are not likely to be the newest. But sooner or later, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good and evil. Thank you.
Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. If there's any topics you'd like to hear covered by Social Justice Matters, please contact us at secretary@socialjustice.ie. A couple of previous episodes, including our 10-minute lesson explaining site value taxes, were actually done as a result of a request from some of our listeners. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you again at the end of August.